The Greens will soon realise that they will need to carry the can and some of the hospital passes for the SNP. The Reform of the Gender Recognition Act, which was kicked down the road because the SNP were too fit to do it themselves because of the war in their own right.
That was Lib Dem leader Alex Cole-Hamilton, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello and welcome to The Stooshie, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode I'll be joined by Adele Merson and Lizanne Kelly to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read to you by Derek Healy.
A UK government minister has said a second independence referendum could take place if polling consistently shows 60% of Scots support having one. Alistair Jack's statement is the first time a minister has defined the conditions for allowing another vote to take place. The Scottish Secretary said support for having a referendum, rather than independence itself, would have to be at 60% for a reasonably long period. The SNP's party accounts reveal it plans to conduct further fundraising for an independence referendum early next year. In an annual statement of the party's finances, Treasurer Colin Beattie said another independence campaign would be needed ahead of critical political watersheds. He acknowledged there had been concerns about transparency over funding appeals that raised more than £600,000. However, he sought to reassure members that all of the money raised will be spent directly on the campaign to win independence. Locals in Kabul say they feel completely broken after hearing explosions kill their fellow Afghans in the capital on Thursday. According to officials, at least 60 people were killed and 143 others wounded in two blasts near Kabul's international airport, where people have been gathering in their thousands in efforts to board flights away from the Taliban takeover. Britain's evacuation effort in Kabul has entered its final hours, but the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, has admitted around 1,000 Afghans could be left behind.
Thank you, Derek. Right, let's turn our attention into the other week that was with Scottish politics. It's been another busy time, despite the fact that Parliament hasn't been running for a wee while everyone's on summer recess. Adele, the Greens and the SNP came to an agreement, a historic agreement some have called it, and a terrifying agreement others have also dubbed it, where we will see Lorna Slater and Patrick Harvey join the Scottish Government as ministers. You've been covering it this week, mainly the fallout about what's happened with SNP and Green members in the North East, because obviously the Greens have quite the opinion on oil and gas. Adele, can you talk us through what the fallout has been this week?
As you say, finally we've had a deal be agreed after what's felt like very, many months, weeks. I've lost track of when it actually all started. And as you say, there has been quite a bit of fallout. Depending on who you listen to, it's either the best thing that's ever happened or it's a total disaster. Particularly in the Northeast, obviously the deal on the plus side for the SNP is going to make them look like they're taking their sort of environmental credentials really seriously with COP26 around the corner. But on the other side, you've got kind of questions swirling around what this means for the future of oil and gas, and the SNP will have some really tough decisions around that. I mean, it is an area devolved to Westminster, but tough decisions around, I guess, how they kind of frame that whole argument. This week we had an Aberdeenshire councillor, Jeeva Blackett. She is a SNP member, was an SNP member, and she chose to resign from the party following the publication of the deal. And that wasn't, she, you know, didn't mention oil and gas or anything like that. She said her reason in particular was that she felt government policy was being made with little or no understanding of the challenges that remote rural communities face. So the area she represents is sort of a Boyne. It's in Deeside, so it's her priorities are like getting the rural hospital back open in Aboyne and things like that. And she is saying that the SNP government fails to understand how these kind of communities work and that many rural jobs are under threat as a result of the agreement. And that she said the involvement of the Greens will no doubt see an agenda damaging to many of you, her constituents, pushed through the statute book with no thought about the wider impact.
Is that a suggestion that like the Greens are centralised Glasgow and Edinburgh city dwellers who are going to dictate rural policy without really knowing anything about it? And, you know, is that what she's coming across? You know, obviously she didn't mention oil and gas, but is she implying that they'll interfere where they don't really know what they're doing?
Yes, I think so. Well, she certainly understands they maybe don't understand, you know, they don't understand the intricacies of being in a sort of rural area. And that shows that while oil and gas is sort of taking a lot of the headlines, there are other concerns in the Northeast region, because we are such a kind of have such rural areas, there are other concerns there as well. The Conservatives, they've said that they think it could be devastating both for the energy sector, but also just the wider Northeast of Scotland in general. We've obviously seen the sort of future of the A96 road project is a little bit up in the air. They've committed to doing certain sections, I believe, but there's an environmental review taking part for some of the other stretches, and then there's the A9 is meant to be happening as well. So that's two major road projects that have implications in the northeast and north of the country. So it really does feel like it's particularly relevant to this region where I live.
Because I mean, that's an interesting one with the A9 and the A96, isn't it? Because those are two roads that should have really, in hindsight, been drilled 20, 30 years ago, aren't they? They're quite difficult roads to traverse, and quite difficult to consider A roads, really, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, I know people in the north of the country, they feel like they don't have any kind of rail infrastructure, proper rail infrastructure to get to A to B. So the car is their main means of getting from A to B. And as you say, they're relying on not the best roads, and they have pushed for that to be dualled for, it feels like, forever, decades kind of thing. And yeah, they'll be certainly, people up there will be, I'm sure, watching that really closely.
I was up in Elgin. My wife trained up in Elgin at Dr. Grace Hospital. And when I was up visiting her a long time ago now, I was supposed to be getting the train back to Lucas in St. Andrews, where I was working at the time. And I couldn't, because someone had stolen all the copper wire from the train tracks, which meant that all the trains were cancelled from Elgin down south. And ended up having to get a bus, but it was a bus on that A96, and it was like single track road, or it felt like single track road, certainly, the sort of single carriageway, but it was quite dangerous. But the Greens are suggesting that if you dual every road in Scotland, you're just going to encourage road use. But it's not really quite the same when you go north of the M8, really, is it? Is, you know, the suggestion that you're going to increase the number of cars doesn't quite fit. It's really just trying to bring that part of the infrastructure, or the road infrastructure, up to date, isn't it? It's not a case of worrying about whether or not there'll be more cars, surely.
No, I think that, yeah, the original aim of the A9 project is so that everywhere in Scotland is sort of accessible by dual carriageway. And as you know, up in the north of the country, it's not nearly as populated as like the Central Belt and other places. So I guess the argument that the roads would be kind of chock-a-block of cars wouldn't really hold much sway there.
And then obviously there's the old oil and gas, which I think we've talked about ad infinitum recently, but that really is a real big concern for SNP members than for Green members. Obviously Green members are concerned about the impact that the industry is having on the environment and the very real threat of climate change that we are facing. But we also want a smooth transition from the oil and gas industry to renewables jobs. And do you think there's been any headway made on these two coming together to sort of alleviate the fears of people in the Northeast, or are we still looking down the long barrel, as it were?
I think there's still quite a bit of concern. Oil workers do seem to want to know what this will mean for their jobs. I think I said a couple of weeks ago that it feels like everybody understands the need for this just transition, but we've yet to kind of see how that plays out in practice. You know, what does the just transition actually mean for these oil and gas workers? How do they make that? How do they move to renewables jobs? How are those careers opened up to them? I know there was millions of pounds of funding, I lose track of time, I think it was this week, announced for sort of the just transition and the Northeast, but I don't know what Northeast members are secretly, you know, privately thinking about this, because it's something they have to sell, I guess, to their constituents. But they certainly are publicly sort of welcoming the funding that has been forthcoming.
So we've obviously had one councillor resign from the party. Any rumblings that we're going to get bigger MSPs or MPs that will say, well, do you know what, I can't actually stomach this, I can't sell it, and I can't toe the party line? Anything you've heard?
No, I haven't heard anything of anyone sort of imminently considering doing something similar, but it will certainly be something I imagine we're watching out for happening.
I'm sure this will be a subject that we will focus on in great detail for weeks, months, maybe even years to come. You heard him at the start of the show, and in case you've missed it, Alex Cole-Hamilton was elected unopposed as leader of the Scottish Lib Dems last week. It coincided with the announcement of this SNP Green Deal, so there's quite a chance that you did actually miss it. So we decided to catch up with Mr. Cole-Hamilton. Group head of politics David McDougall sat down with the new leader and asked him if he really was the best dressed man in Scottish politics.
Oh, that's really nice. Have you been speaking to my mum? I don't consciously know that or strive for that. I like nice clothes. Is that a crime? But I try to look nice. But it's also actually just about rising to the occasion. It is an absolute honour to be elected to the Scottish Parliament. It's an honour to become the leader of my party. And I think sometimes it's every day feels like dressing for a job interview in a certain ways, because you've got to give it a respect that most other workplaces would not convey.
Yeah, it's definitely not a crime. I like it. It's that you're elevating the sartorial elegance of Parliament, and that's no bad thing, I don't think.
Thank you.
So you've just taken over as the leader of the Liberal Democrats. What's changed? What can we expect that's new with you at the helm of the ship?
Goodness, what's changed? I mean, I literally became the leader 30 seconds ago. Well, not
okay, what will
Friday.
Change?
What will change? Well, I mean, several things. Firstly, I want to inject some new hope, not just into my party, but into the country as well, because after everything we've been through, Scotland needs new hope right now. And I think we've been held back in recent times by the clash of nationalisms that we see, which is the sort of binary Hobson's choice between the Scottish nationalism of the SNP, but also the Brexit nationalism of the Tory party. And I can't believe that's all there is. So I want to offer the people of Scotland something different. And that starts by winning an audience with them. I am under no illusion as to the task ahead of me in sort of reconnecting with people on that basis. But I know how to do that. I did that in West Edinburgh, where I was re-elected with more votes than any other candidate in the history of the Scottish Parliament. And I did that by building a coalition of people who trusted me again. And so it's about getting that understanding of how to win and how to reconnect with people and taking that beyond the boundaries of the seats we hold. And I think that we will be pushing on an open door, because after effectively a decade of this constitutional washing machine, people are just crying out for something different and a bit more hope.
Well, if you're bringing in new hope, then what was Willie Rennie doing the last 10 years? What did he get wrong?
Willie Rennie, I don't think Willie got anything wrong. I mean, Willie is one of my best friends. I've learned a lot from him, and I will continue to learn a lot from him. Willie has the most recognisable smile in Scottish politics, and he is credited, and rightly so, with the not just the survival of the Liberal Democrats, but the consolidation of our support to the point where people will never again talk about our extinction. I mean, we can never take anything for granted, but when you look at our held seats and we have some of the biggest majorities in Parliament, we can now look forward with confidence to growth and beyond those seats, and that starts with council elections next year. But no, Willie didn't do anything wrong. His was a survivalist strategy initially, that was by necessity. And now he's passed the baton on to me. The party is in good health. Of course, we slipped back a little bit by one seat in the Scottish Parliament elections. But we're now in a position where we can look forward to growth and new horizons. And I think that the public are ready for something different to vote for.
I mean, you say you can look forward to growth, but that's only because the only way is up.
Well,
because as you said, you slipped back. You've lost seats at every election in the last decade.
Well, David, I'm glad you agree.
The surge of the Greens and the SNPs.
Yeah.
No, the only way is up.
Well, I'm very glad that you agree that the only way is up for the Lib Dems, that we have consolidated our base and that we will move forward rather than backwards. No, listen, I'm under no illusions about the challenge ahead of me. We have had a very tough decade as a party, and I know the reasons why, but we are moving beyond that, and we're looking to a fresh new cadre of candidates with bright new policy ideas, like, for example, fighting climate emergency with ferocity and not the nationalism, the baggage of nationalism, which rather inexplicably comes with the Green Party, fighting against state intrusion in people's lives, pushing back on big centralising government. We're the only party who stands for that. A party for that will offer new hope to young people so that we can get Scotland's education back to being the best in the world again. Remember when that used to be? We're nowhere.
No, there. I know. I don't remember when it used to be.
Well,
because, and you know, I was around in education in the 80s and 90s at school. And I don't think Scotland's education system ever was the best in the world.
Well, it was held up as an international exemplar. And we were much higher in the international rankings than we are now. And a lot of that is because of ministerial disinterest. It's also meddling in terms of the curriculum. But also, I think that there are other things alongside education that we are letting young people down on. The first of those is mental health. If your daughter fell off her bike and broke her arm, she'd be in plaster by the end of the day. But if she comes to you with anxiety or self-harming behaviour, she joins the longest queue in the National Health Service. Some children are waiting up to 2 years for first-line child and adolescent mental health treatment. That is a national scandal. And no wonder then that we have such a, such a challenge for our young people in the sense that they have missed so much education. They do not have the opportunities that people growing up in the 80s and 90s, as you describe, had. And it's I think, falls to the political classes to resolve that. And that's not happened up to now. So I'm passionate about changing that.
Well, when we talk about policies, we see the Greens and the SNP with broadly similar slate of policies to you in many areas. You must be a bit envious. They've sort of cornered the market in the policies you're trying to promote.
Not really. I mean, the Greens and the SNP, if you look at the deal, the centrepiece of that deal is another independence referendum. That's something I'm implacably opposed to.
No surprise, though, surely.
No, of course. But they aren't. I mean, they dress in the clothes of the progressive left and or centre left, and they talk a good game in terms of social values and equalities and progress. But in delivery, they've been utterly rubbish. And I think, you know, by their deeds shall you know them. There are warning lights blinking across the dashboard of public policy, whether that is in the educational attainment gap, in the mental health weights I was talking about a minute ago, the missed climate change targets. Remember, the Greens are going to have to carry the can for those as well. In the threadbare state of our police force, in deferred GRA reform, in the fact, and this is absolutely critical, those patients who were told by Nicola Sturgeon when she was health secretary they'd be seen in 12 weeks, they get a letter guaranteeing them that they'll be seen in 12 weeks when there isn't a hope that they will be seen in 50. That is, you know, that is the sort of reach and extent of ministerial disinterest in this country. Because why? Because Green ministers and SNP ministers have got a weather eye on the constitution above anything else, and our citizens are suffering because of it.
So if there's this litany of faults of the SNP government, why were they overwhelmingly returned as the biggest party in Holyrood just 3 months ago?
There's a very simple answer to that, David. If you look at the poll, the opinion polling before the snap general election of 2019 was pretty scary for the SNP. They were back into the mid-30s. They were given a reprieve at the general election because they managed, with the help of Boris Johnson, and let's remember Boris Johnson finds innovative ways of driving people into the arms of the SNP every single week. But with Boris Johnson, with that election, they were given a reprieve because people were forced into this idea that it was a choice between Boris and Nicola. That gave them the result that they got at the general election. But then again, people started to look at the deficiencies of government. They started to slide again, and then the pandemic hit. Nicola Sturgeon was then on television for every single day for a year at lunchtime, telling people stuff they really needed to hear. And she did so in a solemn managerial way, which people appreciated. At that point, you know, I was knocking doors when we were allowed to after the first knockdown. I could see it everywhere. People were saying, well, I'm usually a Lib Dem, but goodness, Nicola's done a good job, hasn't she? Presentationally, she had done, but actually, in reality, we weren't that much better than the rest of the UK. And so it was that in the Scottish election, when the opinion polls showed the SNP starting to slide, and they did, 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out, they started putting out leaflets saying, who do you want to lead us through the pandemic? And actually, they tapped into a seam of support there where people actually said, well, you're right, this is effectively a wartime government. We cannot change horses in midstream during an international crisis. And they returned to the polls. But that's why I think her mandate for independence, that she didn't get the overall majority, even with the Greens, whilst they have an overall majority in the parliament between them on the regional list vote, they did not get more than 50% of the popular vote, that any mandate they suggest they have for a second independence referendum is tainted because they pivoted halfway through the campaign towards let's focus on the pandemic and putting the recovery first. Who do you want to lead us through that, rather than vote for us and we'll deliver and do FT?
So talking of that Green and SNP alliance, what do you think the Greens' chances are? Will they be chewed up and spat out like your party was by the Tories?
Well, I mean, I can't really offer much advice about my coalition, my party's coalition with the Conservative Party, because I wasn't involved. I wasn't in politics at the time. I'm the first post-coalition generation Liberal Democrat to reach the leadership of the Scottish Party. But listen, you know, I've looked at the agreement. It looks like pretty thin gruel for the Greens. I mean, it's a nice little retirement plan for Patrick Harvey, I'm sure, with the ministerial salary. I'm being disingenuous. I jest. I'm sure he's doing it for what he thinks are the right reasons. But the Greens will soon realise that they will need to carry the can and some of the hospital passes for the SNP. For example, GRA reform, the reform of the Gender Recognition Act, was kicked down the road because the SNP were too fit to do it themselves because of the war in their own ranks. They'll hand that to the Greens, and the Greens will happily lead that, I imagine. And yet that's going to put them at the heart of this unfortunate culture war. Secondly, I think that the people who were voting Green because of the climate emergency, and I know many people who were, and let's remember there was a poll during the Scottish election campaign which said that more than 50% of Green supporters did not back independence, will soon see that the centrepiece of this deal between the Greens and the SNP is another independence referendum. And that does make them the gardening wing of the SNP, as I've heard them uncharitably described. And I think that that means that they have a real danger of losing those educated, free-thinking, Green, left of centre, Liberal voters who were backing them because they wanted to put the climate change emergency above everything else, who will be surprised that that plays second fiddle to the Constitution.
Alex Cole-Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us today on The Stooshie.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you, David and Alex. Right, let's turn our attention to what else has been happening this week. And we are joined by DC Thompson data editor Leslie Ann Kelly. Just when we thought we were out, it looks like the coronavirus is pulling us back in. Numbers are on the rise, and there is grumblings and mumblings that we could be having so-called circuit breakers. But a bit of good news on our part. First, it seems that Leslie Ann's amazing data trackers, which have been charting the rise and fall and rise and fall and rise again of the coronavirus in Scotland and the rest of the UK, have hit a million views. That's pretty good, Leslie Ann, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, a million people have looked at your work. Certainly a million more than I've ever looked at mine.
I honestly do kind of wish people hadn't told me the number of people that looked at the trackers every day, because it just piles on the pressure to get things up promptly at 2 p.m. every day of my life. So
heavy lies the head that wears the crown.
Exactly.
Can you talk us through a bit, just refresh our memories, what the coronavirus tracker does and what sort of information people can expect from it?
It's been tracking the course of the COVID pandemic since the 18th of March 2020. That was when it went live, and it's been tracking basically all available metrics that we have. Since then, we've got kind of top line figures of cases, deaths, things like that, hospitalizations, and you can look for information for your local area, your local authority, your health board area. Some of the trackers, there are a few different ones, and some of them have data going down to neighbourhood level as well. We also have a vaccine tracker that shows how the rollout of the vaccination progress is going in your area as well. So yeah, I'm sure if you click on the coronavirus section of any of our websites, you'll be able to find those trackers.
So it appears that with schools going back and restrictions lifting across the country, the case numbers are going up. We have had our highest number of recorded cases shown this week. Was this a surprise, do you think, or is this something we should be expecting as life begins to peter back to normal?
I don't think it's a surprise. I think we always knew cases were going to increase, and there's got to come a moment where we stop looking at cases in terms of being a useful metric and look at the other things that are available, like deaths and hospitalizations. One of the good things to say is hospitalizations are rising, but they're not anywhere near peak levels. There's a lot of confounding factors that go into hospitalizations. We know right now, Nicola Sturgeon said in the unscheduled briefing this week, that more than half or around half of the cases are in under 25s. And what tends to happen when you have a lower age demographic with the cases is that, just regardless of vaccination status, the number of deaths and hospitalizations will be lower because it's younger people that are getting the disease. Whereas when at our peaks in 2020, we had a lot more older people getting the disease and they're more likely to die, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. This week, we've also seen the latest reported R number going above one fully for the first time in a while. So it's now between 1 and 1.3.
So what's the R number again? That's the rate of infection, is it?
It's the rate of infection, yes. If the average number, if you, Paul, were to get coronavirus, how many people would you go on to pass it on to?
Right.
So if it's below one, then rates of infection are falling. If it's above one, then we're starting to become a bit of a worry again. So yeah, between 1 and 1.3 means the average person is infecting at least one other person, which is not what we want to see for cases reducing. One of the interesting things that I've seen, and it's one of the things that is starting to be words that I'm seeing more and more and more, like I know that we've seen throughout the pandemic, there's been words that have come up, like when I've been dealing with the coronavirus tracker, it's always having to be on top of what the latest coronavirus trends are. R numbers was one of them. I'm sure Adele remembers when her and I worked on a explainer on the R number, when that was the new thing that we had to explain to people. And there's lots of new words now. One, the big thing right now is the phrase waning immunity, which is the kind of worrying thing that's coming out of the latest statistics. There was a recent report from Oxford University that showed that people's immunity is lowering over time, which is what epidemiologists would have expected to happen, but it is worrying as cases are increasing that may have an effect on the number of people getting severe levels of the disease. One interesting thing in that is that it seems to be dependent on which type of vaccine you got as well. So I know there were some people back when the blood clots around AstraZeneca started to be in the news were a bit upset that that was the vaccine that they'd gotten, but they might be happy now to know that that's actually the vaccine, according to this study, that has slightly higher levels of ongoing immunity, whereas the Pfizer vaccine, that's the vaccination that I got, tends to wane a little bit quicker over time. We're also seeing that data being backed up a bit by what we're seeing in Israel, which was one of the first kind of canary in the coal mine type of countries of. It was one of the first countries to vaccinate huge swathes of the population really quickly. And what we're seeing now is that the link being broken between cases and hospitalizations in Israel is not quite as strong. So we are seeing evidence coming out of that country that waning immunity is a phrase that we're probably going to hear more and more of, and is probably going to be something that we're going to have to think about, whether that's booster vaccinations in the near future or I don't know.
There's no real suggestion that we'll go back into any sort of lockdown, is there?
That's an entirely political decision. That's not a decision I can say based on the data. I personally think that putting the toothpaste back in the tube at this point, now that everybody has reintroduced themselves back into society, is going to be very, very difficult to do any kind of lockdown. I think the hospitality industry has been so, its economy has been so impacted that doing anything to do with large gatherings or cutting down things like that is going to have a massive impact when they're just getting back on their feet. But yeah, that's a political issue which we might learn a bit more about at the unscheduled briefing today, maybe.
How relevant is testing? And I know that I've, over the course of the pandemic, didn't do much testing. And then as things have opened up, I've done two lateral flow tests, which are pretty invasive and pretty horrible. Mm-hmm. But you sort of just, it's one of those things that we're kind of accepting now. And I know that, so in September, I'm going to see Biffy Clyro at Glasgow Green. And that's been dubbed a special event or a sort of test event by the Scottish Government. Where when I turn up with my tickets on the gate, I also have to show that I've had a negative lateral flow test in the last 48 hours. Surely, though, with more people, I mean, if you've got 20 or 30,000 people going to this gig, that's 20 or 30,000 extra tests that you're going to have. Surely that's going to cause an increase in the number of positive cases seen, where these people might have traditionally, if they felt a bit cold, they might have just stayed at, sorry, if they felt the symptoms of the virus, they might have just stayed at home but not done a test and sort of wrote it at home. Is this what you mean, why we would have to maybe change how we look at the data in terms of positive tests and
possibly
number of tests and positive cases?
Positive cases in the daily data that we get are only cases that are recorded from PCR tests. So lateral flow tests do not come into any of that whatsoever. On the day that we had the high, Thursday, where we had over 5,000 cases, we also had a high in tests, and it was nearly 50,000 tests that had been done. But that only includes PCR testing. And there's a good reason for that, because I don't know if you're the same, but I wasn't actually aware until recently that when you do a lateral flow test and it's negative, you're still meant to report that. I was sure I had read somewhere that you just had to, you know, dispose of that test. You only reported positive ones, but that's apparently not the case. But the lateral flow data, because of trusting people to input that data, is not the most robust. So that the lateral flow data doesn't come into any of the case data or testing data that is published, and the case positivity rate doesn't include lateral flow. So I think it's lateral flow testing is a whole separate issue in terms of that data.
Right. Speaking of proof of test or proof of vaccine, Adele, the COVID vaccine passport that the Scottish Government has promised, that's all sorted now, isn't it?
No, the app is still in development.
Still?
Yes, I've been in touch with them, I think, three times now since August 10th, and have had the same response, I'm pretty sure, almost word for word, which says they are developing an app to make it easier to show COVID status for international travel, and that will include vaccination records and a QR code, and we aim to release this next month. So that's September. So we're days away from September. So we will be watching in September to see if this app, which has been created by a Danish company for they got £600,000 contract to do so, to see if that materializes. But it sort of reared its head again this week because Liam Kerr, the Northeast MSP, has been contacted by several oil and gas workers in the Northeast. Again, back to oil, there's a kind of strong connection between Norway and Aberdeen because of the oil and gas industry. You'll find a lot of Northeast oil and gas workers go over there to work, and sometimes vice versa. And what they're finding is in Norway, they are only accepting a QR code system, like an app-based system. So the Northeast oil and gas workers are finding that while their colleagues and others are able from England, Wales and Northern Ireland are able to go over, and if they have the app, they don't have to quarantine in a hotel and things like that. So they're able to do that, but because Scotland is relying on this paper-based system, it means that they are having to do, I think one engineer said that he had to do three separate PCR tests and quarantine in a hotel. Another said that they had just decided to not sort of go to Norway because it was too, at the moment, because it was too much kind of effort and cost. So there's definitely pressure there to get this app sort of off the ground.
Just another thing that we've been promised during the pandemic that really just should be done rather than talked about being done. Thank you, Adele. That's all we have time for this week. Thank you, Adele and Leslie and producer Derek. And of course, to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, and even after, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Oh, and a special note, we are celebrating our 100th episode next week. Please do make sure and join in. There'll be some special guests, or David Clegg at the very least. Cheerio. Bye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe, or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.